court is ready to hear argument in 040575, Columbia Medical Center of Las Colinas versus Athena Health.
May it please the court, Mr. Rich Cooper will present argument to petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is a medical malpractice case that presents several issues. The first issue that I would like to address with the court concerns the manner in which the trial judge submitted the charge in this case.
Was it intentional?
It was intentional, Your Honor.
What was the It's not clear to me from the briefs what the thinking was.
Well, we have a reference in our brief where the trial judge referred to phase three of the case sort of as a bill. And the best we could tell, and again, I was not the trial lawyer who tried this case, was that he went through phase one, he refused to submit it to phase one, went through phase one, went through phase two, and then
and phase two was
phase two was the punitive damages. It then got decided that perhaps we ought to go ahead and give a finding with respect to contributory negligence because maybe it should have been submitted, and then he decided to go into phase three at that point.
And was there any more evidence taken after the verdict in phase two?
There was no additional evidence. There was, however, additional closing argument that was allowed by the parties after phase two.
But he decided, but the trial judge decided before the first submission to the jury that this is the way it was going to be submitted.
Well, it was, if you look at the record, I'm not so sure that it was that firm at the time the original submission was done. There was, he refused to submit the contributory negligence question. There was an objection made by counsel for the hospital at that point in time.
Now, if he denied your requested submission before the first jury deliberation phase, correct?
That's correct, Justice.
Well, at the bottom of that denial, it's written request denied until third phase.
Which
so
indicates
it, so it
he
seems
was
thinking that he intended to submit your contributory negligence question, but only during the third phase. Is that accurate?
Correct. That was written on the tendered.
Okay. Now that would make perfect sense if the trial court felt there might not be evidence of contributory negligence. I mean, the way we've crafted the law regarding charges is if you have any doubt whether there's any evidence, carve it out, submit it as a separate question. So if we look at the evidentiary piece, in Axelrad versus Jackson, the 14th Court of Appeals determined when there's a duty to volunteer information and when there's not. There appears to be a pretty significant factual dispute among the parties as to the conditions in which he presented to the hospital and the information he was requested and given. If the trial court felt like there is no duty to volunteer information that you don't think would be relevant, and if, in fact, he responded truthfully to the questions asked, no chest pain, if the trial court felt that was the case, then he would have erred to submit contributory negligence if there was no evidence to support it.
Except, and agree, I disagree, one, with the narrowness of the Axelrad holding, and as this court is aware, that case is currently before this court. I also disagree that there was no evidence. But three, and we've all seen this, if there is a question about whether or not the issue should or should not be submitted, generally most judges will submit it in the appropriate time.
Well, but now we've been very careful about charge error now. We've said if you fail to carve it out and ask it separately, it's going to result in a new trial as opposed to a rendition. So I'm just saying it's hard for me to act as though the trial court was just crazy here when it sounds to me like that's what the trial court was trying to do.
This is not a Castile or a Harris County issue because in the issue that was tendered by the defendant in this case, there were separate blanks for the negligence of the hospital and a separate blank for the contributory negligence of the plaintiff. So there is no Castile problem. There would be no Harris County versus Smith problem if the court had submitted it, as this court indicated in Lemos versus Montez, that it should be submitted, and as the pattern jury charge indicates that it should be submitted.
Could you argue contributory negligence during your closing and after the first phase?
No. In fact, the trial judge specifically refused to allow argument. 24, reporter's record, pages 32 through 33, the trial court refused to allow trial counsel for the hospital to argue contributory negligence on the part of the plaintiff in this case.
Was there argument on contributory negligence before the third phase of jury deliberations?
We were not allowed to argue contributory negligence until the third phase of this case.
But you argued Mr. Hoag's failure to reveal his medical condition as a causation element in the first phase.
The trial judge, and again, if you look on pages 32 and 33, did allow us to go into the facts. The fact, what the doctor was operating with, what knowledge the hospital was operating with. That was allowed to be addressed in closing argument. That is correct.
Counsel, can you give us your strongest arguments for how the timing of the submission of the contributory negligence harmed your client? Why is it not harmless error at this point?
Sure. First off, there's a case that we brought to the court's attention, General Electric versus Small, which says when you are looking at the right of a defendant to submit an affirmative defense, that right must be determined not after looking in hindsight at how the jury answered issues in the charge, but looking at how the evidence was at the time the case should have been submitted. Second, this court, in Accord versus General Motors, says if the trial judge gives an instruction of the law, a correct instruction of the law, that is harmful error in a hotly and closely contested case. So even if the trial court gives, in the appropriate phase of the case, a correct instruction on the law, this court has said that is harmful error. What do we have in this case? We had first phase one, where trial counsel for the hospital was precluded from arguing for contributory negligence. The jury found the defendant was negligent.
But the question is, ultimately, you could argue it. And so what I'm trying to understand is, how did that impact the case as a whole, the timing of the submission?
This way, Your Honor. By the time the jury was afforded the opportunity to address the contributory negligence, they had gone through phase one and found that the defendant was negligent and grossly negligent, awarded over $9 million in damages. They had gone through phase two and awarded over $21 million in punitive damages. They finally get to phase three. Trial counsel in phase three is allowed to argue that the jury should consider the work that it's already done in answering this question. That is, the jury is to consider the answers that they've already rendered in answering this important question.
How long was the jury out on the phase three question?
It was a very short time, Your Honor. I don't have the exact time with me. I can get it, but it was not very long.
And the first phase, how long were they out?
I'm sorry, I don't have that in my notes here. I apologize.
Was there an issue raised at directed verdict stage on contributory negligence?
There was. And there was
so
two.
The plaintiffs moved for directed verdict on contributory negligence.
There were two issues, Justice Wainwright, regarding contributory negligence. One had to do with the failure of Mr. Hoag. He was told back in 1996 that he had a heart murmur. He was told by his PC, primary care physician, to go see a doctor, a cardiologist, and get a chest x-ray, to get an EKG. He did not do that. The trial judge said that is not contributory negligence. Evidence of that was not allowed to come in, and that was not argued. There was discussions regarding the second issue of contributory negligence, and that is the failure to give an accurate history upon admission. There was discussions regarding directed verdict, and apparently the trial judge, you know, at one point in time it looks like he might grant it, then he comes back and decides to go ahead and submit it in phase three of the case. And so the best we can tell is that he decided, if it was granted, that it was ungranted by the submission in this particular case.
Can you say if it was granted, it was ungranted? Is it unclear how that ruling at directed verdict came out?
Well, at one point in time, as I recall, Justice Wainwright, he indicated that he was going to grant it. Then, later on in the record, as I recall, he indicated that he was going to go ahead and submit it in this phase three.
The medical center's brief says Hogue denied any cardiac symptoms or history, and Hogue's brief said, at no time did anybody ask Hogue if he had previously been diagnosed with heart problems. Those seem conflicting.
Let me show the court the record. There was an admission sheet, a T sheet, which is in the record. Defendant's exhibit, page 16, was filled out by Dr. Blomquist upon admission. And one section here is past history. One issue is heart disease. Dr. Blomquist testified on volume 16 in reporter's record, pages 236 through 241, that he went over with Mr. Hogue about his heart history and past history of heart disease, and he indicated no, there wasn't. You go to, this is Dr. Blomquist again.
Who was filling out the form?
The emergency room physician.
And he asked if Mr. Hogue was experiencing chest pain.
He did.
And he responded no.
That is true.
Where is it in the record that he asked him, have you had a prior heart condition?
If you go to pages 238, volume 16, reporter's record, 239. 239, for example, the first part of searching my mind is the history. I specifically asked him, as you can see by this T-sheet, this is Dr. Blomquist testifying, by this test template about specific cardiac problems. The man could not breathe. I asked him, do you have chest pain? Do you have a family history? Do you have risk factors for any type of heart disease, which includes smoking, family history? Do you have a history of high blood pressure, high cholesterol? None of those. And how did that affect your search for a potential heart problem, given the fact that he denied having any types of symptoms or history? His answer was, to my mind, it moved the heart problem lower on the differential diagnosis list. You go on to page 241. Ask whether or not he'd been told about the heart history problem. Would it have affected his treatment of Mr. Hogue in this case? It certainly would have caused me to look more deeply. Dr. Blomquist also testified in the record that he talked to Mrs. Hogue. That's page 121 of volume 16 of the reporter's record. She said, and this is her testimony, did he have a heart problem, a history of heart problems? And her, she said, I told him no, that he didn't.
So, well, you're lying there, and something is seriously wrong. You're not always thinking clearly enough to be saying, oh, well, yeah, there was this time.
I agree, but this was less than 18 months earlier, Your Honor. And the issue here, though, is that is an argument, but we're applying the standard of review for whether or not an issue is to be submitted.
Well, it was submitted, right? It just wasn't submitted when you wanted it submitted.
It was submitted in phase three, that's correct. But applying the standard review, indulging in all inferences in favor of the party seeking the issue, we believe clearly this would be sufficient to raise a fact issue on the issue of whether or not we knew he had a heart history, murmur. We knew, according to Dr. Blomquist, that it was asked, according to the T-sheet. And we knew, according to Dr. Blomquist, Dr. Schroeder, that it wasn't revealed. Now, why it wasn't revealed, that's an argument that they may have regarding he was too ill, et cetera, et cetera. But from the applicable standard of review on whether or not this issue should have been submitted in phase one, we believe it clearly creates a fact issue which would require the trial judge in this case.
Your rule is that everybody whose negligence is alleged and as to whom there is some evidence, they've got to all be in one question.
We believe that Rule 277 in this court's pronouncement in Lemus versus Montez is that all the issues, defensive issues, should be submitted in the primary phase of the case unless good cause exists.
Can you think of any reason why you would have a second negligence question as to one party, plaintiff or defense?
Cannot. And in fact,
there's no evidence to support it.
Well, that's not that. Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't believe that would be a reason to put it in a separate phase. Because if there is no evidence, regardless of what the jury may answer in the primary phase, the court can always disregard that.
But the question one might argue
are we speculating on what the jury did in its deliberations? I mean, we usually presume the jury read the instruction, read the question, listened to the evidence, and then came up with a verdict based on the evidence and the law as given by the trial court. And my question here is, you're saying, well, because of the timing, you know, the jury had already answered these, and so was predisposed to answer adverse to Columbia. I just don't understand exactly how, you know, what's the precise link to show a harmful error.
Well, you look at, first, the question is, was this a fair submission of the issues in this case, which this court has said that's the test for.
So let's assume it was not a fair submission, that we, that the court would agree unanimously that it should have been in phase one, if we're going to call these phases. The question I have is, how have you demonstrated that there is harmful error? How do we know that the jury didn't look precisely at the question submitted, evaluate arguments of counsel, you know, and determine, you know, that they're going to do?
Go back to Accord versus General Motors, and that is, if it's a hotly contested case, any instruction which tilts or nudges the jury in favor of one party or the other is going to be deemed and presumed to be harmful error by this court.
Thank you. Further questions?
Mr. Chief Justice, I have one.
Yes.
In Accord, was there an objection to the manner of submission on the basis that it was somehow a comment on the weight of the evidence or did nudge the jury?
In the court case?
Yes, sir.
In the court case, there was an objection. There was an instruction that was given in that case on the law, a correct instruction.
But did the opposing counsel, counsel complaining, make an objection to the manner of submission as nudging the jury or commenting on the weight of the evidence?
My recollection in the court, and again, it's been a while since I read it, was that it was an improper instruction to be going to the jury. I don't believe there was an objection in the court case that it tilted or nudged the jury. I believe that language came from this court's opinion in the court case.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Eric Pearson will present argument from the respondents.
May it please the court. There were several questions by the justices, including Justice Wainwright and Justice Patton, about what the trial court was thinking when it decided to submit the issues in the manner in which it did. And I'd like to try to clarify the record on that point, if I may. In volume 24 of the reporter's record, pages 31 through 32, the court very clearly granted the plaintiff's directed verdict on the contributory negligence theory. The court stated the court is going to grant the plaintiff's motion in full on the directed verdict as to both branches of the defendant's Section 33 contrib. And the branches are, the one branch was Mr. Hogue's alleged failure to follow up on his advice of his cardiologist 2 years prior, and the other, his alleged failure to inform the doctors of this heart murmur.
Of course, they can't complain about that anymore now, can they?
No, they can't.
Because the trial judge at the last minute gives what the trial judge calls the last question.
Exactly, Your Honor. And it's very clear from reading the transcript that the court granted the directed verdict. He says, I'm also granting it as to causation. And referring to the second prong, this argument about Mr. Hogue not being forthright with his doctors, the court said, we haven't heard any evidence of how it would have made a difference if he had told them. And so in that charge, and then in a charge conference before the third phase, the court said, are there any objections other than what I've already sustained, which is your objection that it be submitted, and I've already sustained that. He's talking to Mr. Werber, the trial counsel for the plaintiff. Hence, we're doing it in the trifurcated way.
And why?
Why, Your Honor? I believe it was done.
I mean, if you granted a directed verdict, why give the issue?
I believe it was done out of an abundance of caution.
Well, then why not give it in phase one?
Because the court didn't feel like the evidence mandated its submission.
So your rule is we give the, in one question, the defendants the judge thinks did do it, and in a separate question, we give the names of the people the judge thinks aren't liable, because, of course, the judge really wants the jury to get the first ones.
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that this is the way that it ought to be done. I mean, there are many cases where the court says it would have been more ideal to phrase the question a certain way, but there was no harm here in the way the question was.
Well, could go ahead.
If there were evidence of contributory negligence, if there were, should the question be submitted this way? Can you think of a situation where it should be submitted this way?
Ideally, it should be submitted in one question. I think it was submitted this way because the court was convinced that there was not evidence to submit.
But if there were, surely this is reversible error.
I disagree, Your Honor, with all due respect. There is an argument to be made that it was an abuse of discretion to split these questions if there was evidence to justify its submission, and I contend there was not. However, clearly, there has to be harmful error analysis.
But and if there was evidence, just take another case and other issues, limitations issues, other kinds of defensive issues, it seems to me that it would be very difficult for the defendant to argue with a straight face after a jury has already decided liability and punitive damages, that it should go free.
Well, I don't know that they were arguing they should go free. They were arguing that Mr. Hogue was contributory negligent and that there should be some percentage of blame placed upon Mr. Hogue, which is the same thing they would have argued had it been in the first phase. And
but you wouldn't feel disadvantaged if you were the defendant arguing in phase three to a jury that had just decided that you owed $30 million to the other side.
No, Your Honor. In fact, they were given a separate closing argument before the third phase in which the only issue they had to focus on and could devote all their time and attention to was Mr. Hogue's alleged contributory negligence.
Would you feel disadvantaged if the only defendant with money was defendant two out of three and the trial judge submitted only defendants one and three in the first question, the first phase? The jury comes back and says they're liable, and then we do exemplary damages. And then, as an afterthought, the judge says, by the way, do you think defendant two was liable? You would object to that, would you not? The one who you really want to recover from being saved to an afterthought third phase.
I would likely object to that, but I think, again, that the issue before this court would be whether that was harmful error. And I disagree with Mr.
Can you tell us how long the jury was out on phase one versus phase three?
I believe they were out slightly longer on phase one than in phase three.
Slightly longer to return $30 million in damages?
I don't know the exact length of how long the jury was.
I mean, the fact of the matter is, the second time the jury comes back with the answer to say, ladies and gentlemen, you're still not done. We've got some more questions for you. At this point, one might reasonably assume a reasonable juror's patience is being tried. Unless they were told we're going to have at least three phases of coming in and going out to the jury room.
I believe they were told before they went out to assess the amount of the punitive damages that there would be another question.
Counsel, assuming you're the plaintiff in a case, if the trial judge says we're going to submit this case to the jury in two phases, the first phase is going to be only affirmative defenses. None of your claims for affirmative relief will be submitted in this phase. Would you feel that that's a problem and fairly being able to fairly present your case to the jury and have them deliberate fairly on the facts? Only affirmative defenses first, knowing your claims for affirmative relief will come later after the jury's determination on the affirmative defenses. Is that
I would argue that that was unfair and that it's more sensible to establish liability before an affirmative defense. And really, all the time there are...
Well, it's more sensible to determine liability before determining damages, too, but that didn't happen in this case. Not complete liability.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
And so again, affirmative defenses submitted first, then your claims for affirmative relief submitted after the jury comes back, and that's put into a phase two. Does that cause you a problem as a plaintiff?
I think that would essentially change the burden of proof in that the plaintiff is supposed to be allowed to present their theory of liability and then the defendant can raise defenses. That would spin that around to change the burden. Here, the burdens were not changed.
I'm not sure if that's true or not, but let's put that to the side. I'm just asking about your belief on whether the jury can fairly and accurately reach a verdict on a case when they're presented with the case after the trial. And they're presented with it in the jury charge where there's only affirmative defenses for them to consider.
I don't know
if anything else is coming or not.
I think that in order for this court to reverse, there would have to be some evidence of that error was reasonably calculated to cause and did cause rendition of an improper verdict.
And one final question on this point. A assume the judge also, in submitting only the affirmative defenses in phase one, says you cannot argue your claims for recovery during this first phase. Does that cause you a problem when I add that additional fact?
Again, I think the court would have to look at the particular facts and circumstances, the way the questions were phrased, to determine whether any error was harmful.
Let's assume all of the things you just posited were done perfectly. The only thing I'm asking about is not being able to argue your claims for affirmative relief and having the jury only consider affirmative defenses in a phase one. Everything else in the trial is done perfectly. Do you feel like you've been treated fairly in that case?
I don't think that that harmful error could be shown so long as my liability claims were presented to the same jury in a properly worded question, as was done here.
In a phase two?
In a phase two.
And you think that is okay?
I think that there's no harmful error, as there was no harmful error here.
And what if this becomes a template, the way this case was tried for all personal injury cases, products cases, med mal, car wreck cases, and in each case, there is some evidence there is evidence of contributory negligence. How would we reverse that? How would we stop that trend without a showing of harmful error?
Well, I think first of all, that's not likely to happen, in that this was a case very clearly where the court granted a directed verdict, and really, if there was any error, it was error.
But the court obviously reversed itself on that and decided it's not harmful for me to just stick this on in phase three. Let's say the plaintiffs think this is a good thing, and we're going to ask all the trial courts henceforth to try these cases this way. How could you ever show harmful error?
I think you would have to show, you have to have some evidence of harm.
And what would that be? Tell me what that would amount to in your mind.
I think you have to show that the question was not fairly presented, that the wording of the question was improper.
It was a properly worded question. We're only talking about timing. What in your mind would tip the scales in favor of saying, yeah, this was harmful?
I can't think of anything that would. I think the question is fairly presented to the jury, and they have an opportunity.
So it's okay if trial courts start trying cases like this?
I don't think this is the ideal way to do it, and I think the court here was troubled with the issue. It granted the directed verdict. It felt like there was no evidence specifically of causation, and I would ask the court to look very hard at the issue of whether this question should have been submitted at all. But I don't think that this is going to be the way the courts generically start to submit this issue. This was an issue where the court had numerous charge conferences where there were discussions about this issue.
Well, what do we do in the classic case where the plaintiff's case is weak on liability but strong on damages? It's always been the position and been the position of Texas law since Eiley versus Hughes. You can't separate those, even though logically terrible damages has absolutely no effect on strong or weak liability. But the fact of the matter, we all know if the jury considers all of it together, they may have some effects bleed over. So are you here arguing the position the trial judge could in fact try liability and damages in two phases, where the first phase we don't tell anybody what happened to your client or how sympathetic the family or how bad the injury. We only decide whether anything was done wrong. And if the jury says no to that, we never even get to it.
No, Your Honor, and I believe that Eiley versus Hughes and the other cases cited by the petitioner all involve literal separate trials with literal different juries.
Well, what's the difference in phase three versus literal separate? What is there about phase three that would differentiate separating questions from separate evidence? Couldn't the trial judge, if you were going to do phase three, just said no evidence of contrib until phase three?
Well, I think would certainly present a stronger argument for reversible error. But in this case, during the case in chief, the defendant was able to put on all the evidence they wanted about the alleged.
So the argument is it would be wrong to break up the evidence into phases. But as long as you're sending the jury back and forth to the jury room in phases, that's okay. Why would you want to do that? I mean, we do that with exemplary damages because there's supposed to be some evidence that doesn't come in on the first phase that does on the second. That's not the case with contrib.
I agree, Your Honor, and this is not, I'm not saying this is the ideal way to do it or a template. This was a situation in which the court believed there was no evidence of causation, that the issue should not be submitted. And then for some reason he says, I still agree with the plaintiffs, but I'm submitting at this point because I can't see any harm. He was saying, I'm going to go ahead and submit it because that way we'll know for sure if I have erred or not. This is not the usual case. This is not a template for the best way to do it.
But I think Justice Owen is correct, though. It certainly could be argued, if we were to rule the way you like this court to rule, that the Columbia case now stands for the proposition that it doesn't matter what order you submit the questions, as long as they're ultimately submitted.
Well, I don't think that argument would be adopted by the trial court. Again, this is a very unusual situation in which the court felt that there was no evidence to submit the question, and out of an abundance of caution, submitted it in a final phase. And it's interesting to note that Columbia has not appealed the directed verdict. There's nothing on the record where the court indicated I'm overruling my prior ruling on the directed verdict.
Yeah, but a trial judge can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, I directed verdict and I'm submitted to the jury. You either did one or the other.
Well, he did submit it to the jury, as right. We all know.
So you can't say, well, I'm granting the summary judgment, but I'm also going to let a jury find the verdict, and whichever one I get upheld on appeal will stand. I mean, if you send it to trial, you send it to trial. Trial merges everything that goes before.
Yes, Your Honor, and the question was submitted, and I disagree with one thing Mr. Cooper said, which is, citing to the Schmall case, that you can't look at what happened after the fact. This court in the Island Recreational case made very clear that to determine whether an error is reversible, the court needs to consider the charge in its entirety. And the charge in its entirety submitted the exact question that Columbia wanted submitted. Was Mr. Hogue negligent? The answer was no.
But other than this case and punitive damages where the legislature requires it, are you aware of any other case where judges send the jury back and forth with additional questions?
There are cases that we cited in our brief where the issues were broken up. For example, the Rozell case, where the court submitted questions about the bus company's negligence for their own driver separately from a question that had all the other defendants in the question. The court found no harmful error there. Also, the Miller versus Walmart case, where there was a predicate question as to whether Walmart was negligent by selling ammunition to a minor, that was separate and apart from questions about generically Walmart and other defendants. The court found no harmful error. Fought versus Boswell, a car wreck case where both the plaintiff and defendant were blaming the other. The court submitted.
Perhaps I should have been more specific.
I'm sorry.
Where this court has ever said to do that?
No, Your Honor, but this court has said that the issue is harmful error. And here, I think if the court looks at the record carefully, in fact, even the portion that Mr. Cooper read to the court, the questions that were asked of Mr. Hogue were very specific questions about smoking, family history, chest pains. In fact, curiously, throughout Columbia's brief, they talk about if there have been evidence of chest pain. The fact is, Mr. Hogue wasn't experiencing chest pain. There's no evidence to the contrary. He honestly and accurately answered every question of him. This was not a situation like in the Elmore versus Smith case.
We're not saying they have a strong case. I'm not concerned with those questions. I read this record and I'm shocked at somebody just constantly being, we'll get back to you in hours until the guy dies. Our question is how it's tried, not whether you should have won or not. So why? I mean, it does look like this question was an afterthought.
Counsel, let me ask a question going to that. Was there, in fact, an argument by the plaintiff during the third phase that the jury should and could consider what it had already done?
There was a remark by counsel to that effect, which was not objected to.
Okay. Assuming it's not objected to, does that not then demonstrate one of the problems here? It seems like, excuse me, in that argument does... submitting the case this way builds upon itself and does, in fact, almost induce that type of argument and that type of trial. Look what you did back there. You've already found things. Do we not start down that road once we separate these issues as was done here?
I don't think so, because as the court knows, there can be more than one proximate cause of an event. It wasn't an either-or situation.
But was that a proper argument?
Well, if it wasn't, any error was waived because
my question was: was it a proper argument as you stand here today? Was that it had already occurred in the trial? It was part of the proceedings. Was it or was it not a proper argument?
I don't think there's anything improper about it. It was an offhand remark. It was not explored any further.
So even if we had an objection to that and we start trying these cases this way, then your position would be it's proper to submit it piecemeal and then to argue to the jury based upon what's already happened in their decisions. We've already had a peek, so to speak, at this jury's thought processes, and we can nudge them a little further by our arguments. Well, either side, plaintiff or defendant, whichever way it goes.
Again, I'm not saying that because in this case it was an offhand remark. There was no attempt in the third phase for the plaintiff, and there's nothing in the record to support any type of allegation like this where the plaintiff said, look, you already found the hospital negligent, therefore Mr. Hogue's not negligent. I mean, there was no specific
reference. That's what I'm asking. That's the logical extension of the argument. You can consider what's already gone on in the case, is it not? Wouldn't that be a proper argument? It has, in fact, gone on. You're not going outside the record. You've got the finding. Would that not be a proper way to argue the case? Either side, whoever was being benefited.
Well, obviously, I think on the issue of the comparative responsibility of Mr. Hogue in the hospital, if they were to find him negligent, you could refer to the conduct of the hospital that had led the jury to find the hospital negligent when you're arguing about the percentage causation. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that's, I mean, this question was submitted the exact way it would have been as Columbia wanted it, except in two phases. And there's been no explanation of any harm in that. The cases that have been cited to are cases in which the jury was tilted or nudged. And those all involve cases where the very instruction was intended to nudge the jury, like a spoliation instruction. Or in the Accord case that Mr. Cooper cited, it was a situation where it had to do with a manufacturer is not an insurer of his product. I mean, those are cases in which you were trying to nudge the jury. This was the exact question they wanted, just split in two phases. And again, I would urge the court that if it's inclined to hold that the manner in which this question was submitted was an abuse of discretion and should not be condoned for some fear that it become a template, that the court should hold that in this case it was not harmful error because there was no factual evidence to support the submission. And most importantly,
let me ask you this. The way it was structured, the jury was asked, did the negligence of the hospital approximately caused the occurrence in question? The answer was yes. And what was originally requested was the typical comparative responsibility, apportioned between yes or no as between these two. If you answered yes as to both, then apportion. So it was structured differently. Wasn't that in itself a nudge to the jury?
No, Your Honor, the question was Mr. Hogue, did his negligence, if any, approximately cause the
what was originally requested was, did the negligence, if any of those named below, approximately cause occurrence in question? And then they had A, the hospital, and it says C, and it should have been B, Mr. Hogue. So the jury, they've got them side by side in the same question, whereas the question that was initially asked was, did the negligence of the hospital approximately cause the occurrence in question?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they weren't considering them at the same time.
They weren't, but they did in the third phase, and they found it.
But not side by side, like they were. You would have been asked in the traditional comparative responsibility.
Not side by side, but again, if the question is, did it affect their determination of whether Mr. Hogue was negligent, you could have a mountain of evidence that the hospital was negligent, and that doesn't negate a possible negligence by Mr. Hogue. It wasn't an either-or situation. So the jury, there really is no conflict in them saying yes in the first phase and no in the third. And again, there was no, this question did not need to be submitted because there was no evidence of proximate cause. And I would ask the court to look carefully at that.
Counsel, as we know, the judge excluded Mr. Hogue from the first question in the first phase. And then the second question in the first phase, the judge submitted the instructions, do not reduce the amounts, if any, in your answers because of the negligence, if any, of Robert Hogue, Jr. Why was that instruction needed in question two if Mr. Hogue was not submitted in question one?
Well, I think that actually goes to show that the jury had been given evidence. The defendant was given
It goes to show that the jury had been given evidence of what?
That the defendant had been able to put on evidence of the alleged contributory negligence of Mr. Hogue, and the court had already decided that in the third phase they will be able to determine whether that constituted negligence, and so the jury was required in answering the damage question, as they are in all damage questions as set forth in the patent jury charge, to not reduce the damages because of any alleged negligence by Mr. Hoag. And again, they were given free rein to put on all the evidence in their case in chief they wanted on that. Even during their closing argument on the first phase, they were permitted to argue the facts. In other words, the reason we didn't diagnose him sooner was because he didn't tell us. They just couldn't argue specifically right, you know, contributory negligence, but they were able to articulate all the facts.
So this instruction is not needed unless the jury had heard some evidence that might lead them to reduce damages based on Mr. Hoag's negligence. Is that what you're saying?
I think that comes from the pattern jury charge, and it's submitted that way.
But the instruction is not needed if there's absolutely nothing to suggest that Mr. Hoag may have contributed to his injuries, right?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
It's there for a purpose, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Pastor.
Thank you.
A couple issues I'd like to address. First, with respect to Justice Brisker, about Allie B. Hughes and how liability and damages are interconnected, that you can't remand for separate trials. This court in 1989, in a case called Otis Elevator versus Bedford, was faced with a remand, and I believe it was from the San Antonio Court of Appeals, where they were only going to remand the issue of the defendant's negligence. And this court said, no, you cannot do that. You've got to remand not only the defendant's negligence, but you have to remand the plaintiff's contributory negligence as well, because they are interconnected, they are intertwined, and you can't have a trial just on one.
My understanding is the echo that was eventually done did detect heart problems.
There was a leakage in the valve when the echocardiogram was done. That is correct, Your Honor.
So what's the evidence of causation that anything would have been done differently if, in fact, he had revealed a heart murmur?
Page 239, volume 16 of the reporter's record. Dr. Blunt was the first part of searching my mind is the history. He said he went through the T-sheet, which I showed the court, defendants exhibit 4,
I understand he said that he would have put that higher on his differential, but that was at an earlier point in time before the echo. Once the echo indicated a heart problem, what harm was caused by the failure to reveal it when he was first admitted?
Well, the problem was in the delay. They called the pulmonologist originally, Dr. Schroeder, because they thought it was lung problems. And they spent hours going through tests for his pulmonary problems when the problem was not in the lung, but was rather in the heart. And they didn't finally get to the heart diagnosis until later that evening, at which time they transferred him to Baylor Hospital in Irving, and it was too late. On the causation, I would like to have been challenged by Mr. Pearson, page 241, volume 16. He was asked about his opinion, Dr. Blomquist. Would the opinion have been affected, sir, if in fact you received different information from Mr. Hoag or his family that he had a physician advise him that he had a heart murmur? And he says it certainly would have caused me to look more deeply. He also testified that he would have called in a different consult, and that he probably would have transferred him to the hospital to Baylor earlier on if he had known about the fact that there was a heart problem earlier on. Last thing I want to point out to the court, the Sandra Hart case, dealing with medical malpractice and contributory negligence. It's not from this court, it's from the Tyler court. But that court said in a medical malpractice case, evidence of contributory negligence of the plaintiff, of the patient, is simultaneous and cooperating with the alleged fault of the defendant. It must have entered into the creation of the cause of action and must have been an element in the transaction which created. And basically what the court was saying is they are inextricably intertwined with the defendant's negligence. And I believe as far as harmful error, again, first off, I resort to the court, but I think the fact that the court didn't submit it to the third phase is a comment by the judge to this jury of what he thinks about the contributory negligence. That in and of itself, I believe, is a comment on the weight of the evidence.
Why is that? If you didn't get to argue it, why would the jury think that is a comment?
That is
excluding Mr. Hoag from the charge is a comment on the evidence.
Why would the jury be deciding the negligence of Columbia, gross, assessing all this, and then finally, almost as an afterthought, we finally get to the last phase, then we're going to go ahead and address Mr. Hogue's negligence.
So I think it was a comment in phase three.
The fact that it was delayed until phase three, I believe that it was a comment. If there are no more questions, we request the case be reversed and removed from
Council, the cause is submitted. That concludes oral arguments for today, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The Honorable.